then is it open to questions?
Yes, definitely.
I'll probably stand up at the podium when it's my turn to speak. Do you need me to be visible when it's not my turn to speak?
No.
Okay.
No.
I don't think I have a usually yet because the first year that the college was founded, I had no role because I had just been hired. So last year was the first one.
Was last year? I had 2, 12, 13, 14. No, this is the third one.
No, this is much busier than I've ever been before.
Me too. I'm trying to figure out why.
Well, we submitted 6 proposals for workshops and we had 5 accepted. We thought maybe 2 or 3 would be accepted.
Right, well, that was part of... I said yes
and then,
to a
and then
lot
I
of
said
things.
Yes to a bunch of other right. people's things. And then a few things have arisen spontaneously, like
all right,
the worship in the middle of the night.
Start. Okay, we're ready.
All right, we are ready to start. And I am supposed to say what this session is. It's the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, Human Rights and Climate Change, and it's program ID 346, because I think this is going to be recorded. And I will start, and then I will introduce the speakers as they are about ready to speak. Meanwhile, I'm still trying to deal with my laptop that is not cooperating, but the PowerPoint actually doesn't come till the end, so I have a few minutes to try to make this work.
Bruce, you should take that mic out and hold it up to your mouth. Oh,
much better. Yeah. Like that? Okay. So I want to start off to talk about the UN Millennium Development Goals. Those were the goals that were set by the UN in 2000, and they go through the end of this year. And they have substantially been achieved. You've read a lot in the press, and certainly it's not 100%. But what I'm hoping to get across in this introductory remarks is that the fact that the globe sets goals and works together towards those goals is a good exercise. And it has been successful. It's the first time the world has actually done anything like this. And we had these Millennium Development Goals. And over this time, global poverty, believe it or not, has actually been drastically reduced around the world. It's not that everybody is in good shape. It's not that we still don't have poverty around the world. But we have made substantial progress on ending global poverty. So the fact that we set that as a goal and had all kinds of strategies and indicators and targets to do that has been a good exercise. Basic education for both girls and boys is now available to most of the world's children, and that's a huge success. We have, the UUUNO has a project in Ghana. It's been targeted at girls, and so we've been actually looking at Ghana since 2005. And when we started in 2005, there were vastly more boys in school than girls. And at the present time in Ghana, throughout the country, not just our project, girls and boys go to school at about the same rate. So they've actually achieved gender parity in Ghana. And that's been the case in a lot of other countries. I don't only speak about Ghana because that's a country that we work in and we know, but other countries have achieved gender parity as well or are working towards it. So that's been a good goal, and we've made a lot of progress in that area. Much progress has been achieved in healthcare, especially in the reductions of mortality due to HIV, AIDS, malaria, infant and maternal mortality. As we all know, AIDS is not the killer that it used to be. It still does kill a lot of people. But with ARV treatment, which is more and more available across the world, a lot of people are living with AIDS. And there's a lot more education being done with children, and so fewer and fewer people are contracting AIDS because of the education and because of our protective measures. So that's been a successful story as well. That's with the AIDS epidemic that we worried about so much has been managed in many substantial ways. So that goal and working towards that goal has been a good thing. There's been greater gender equity and greater access to clean water and nutritious food across the world. So setting global goals and working on a planetary basis to achieve them has been a worthwhile endeavor. So this is the end of the Millennium Development Goals, the end of 2015, that's the end. We are now working on what's called the Sustainable Development Goals. And the emphasis on these goals is very much on human rights and on climate change. And civil society has had a lot to do with that kind of input. The UUUNO has actually been a leader organizing civil society to have input into the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Last summer, there was a period of 2 weeks during the summer where NGOs like ourselves got up one after the other and gave speeches for two weeks, and we all talked about the things that we were concerned about. And we actually kind of were a bit late, and so we were on the last Friday of the last week towards the very end of the whole long period. And one of the things that kind of disturbed us in particular, we are kind of known as the defenders of sexual orientation and gender identity human rights at the UN. We have a very well-earned reputation for being the strong voice in that area. And in all of this 2 weeks of civil society talking about human rights and the Sustainable Development Goals, not one said anything about LGBT rights, not one. So we got up and we gave a really good speech. And I really have to talk about our interns because they did most of the drafting. I did the delivery, but they did most of the research and drafting of this speech. We got a standing ovation for the speech. We were the only speaker in all of the 2 weeks that got that kind of reception. The chairs of the committee, which were the representatives from Kenya and Hungary, both lauded us and said that definitely this was a good effort. And then something else interesting happened, because basically our premise was the Sustainable Development Goals say nobody's going to be left behind. Very nice to hear that. But what usually happens is when they say nobody's going to be left behind, the LGBT people are left behind, regardless of what people say. Well, then other groups started saying, we get left behind too. So we built coalitions with people with disabilities, because they say, we also get left behind. So we started looking at other marginalized groups, and we built a coalition. And we wound up with something like 100 nonprofit organizations. And we did a composite civil society input to the UN that we all agreed on. And we put all of the points that were important to all of us on this composite submission to the United Nations, which included disability rights and gender rights and gender orientation rights and sexual orientation rights, gender identity rights and sexual orientation rights. So it was all there. And so we were quite gratified. And nobody objected to our agenda, just as we didn't object to theirs, because the whole purpose of what we were trying to get across to the UN is that nobody should be left behind. So that was really great work. The other thing that we've looked at very much is climate change. And this is something, and just walk outside if you don't believe in global warming. More seriously, I just got a text message from a friend of mine in Karachi. He says, it is horribly hot and 600 people have died of the heat in Karachi. If you look at the global temperatures, it is getting serious. And a lot of people don't like the word global warming anymore. We tend not to use it much. But the fact of the matter, the globe is getting warmer and there are consequences because of it. So we really want to make sure that these Sustainable Development Goals really look at that. When you finally look at the Sustainable Development Goals, and I'm going to read them to you, you may not hear the language that you may want to hear. I mean, I would love it if they said something about sexual orientation, gender identity, human rights. They're not in the goals. But what we're doing is looking at the targets and indicators. We have verbal agreements with UN officials and with member states. We have networks of NGOs, and so we're well positioned with the people that we have relationships with and the networks of NGOs that we have to ensure success. And what we're finding out as we're getting into this, if you don't count it, it's not real. That's what we're finding out. If you don't count it, it's not real. The other phrase that's kind of the buzz phrase around the United Nations is disaggregated data. So look at education, for example. If you're not counting the disabled and sexual minorities that are getting an education, if you're not counting that specific, those specific demographics, they're not real. They don't really exist. And you can't say that everybody's getting an education unless you're counting those individual groups. And we actually had a wonderful session at the U.S. mission to the UN all about data collection and how it needs to be rigorous and effective, and you have to have this disaggregated data to ensure that you're getting everybody. So again, you may not see LGBT rights in the SDGs, but through the data collection, if we're counting LGBT people in education and healthcare and all these demographics, then they will be included. So that's why we pay such particular attention to data collection and the emphasis on the targets and the indicators. Already, the United Nations pulls together the best climate science that there is. And they work with groups of scientists around the world to collect absolutely the best science there is on the climate. And so we need to pay attention to that. And their data collection on climate science is just going to get better over time. And so we, again, that's part of data collection that's important to understanding what's going on with the climate. And we need to trust what the UN says on it. We have our own national government. President Obama had a report on climate change, which was excellent. But for my money, if you really want to know what's going on with climate science, and some of my panelists may disagree, I don't know, but I think the UN is about the best source you can get. And generally, the UN is not taking extreme positions. So I have a two-minute warning. So I want to get into the Sustainable Development Goals very quickly, just so you know what they are. Goal one is to end poverty in all its forms everywhere. Two, end hunger, achieve food security, and improve sanitation, and promote sustainable agriculture. Three, ensure healthy lives and promote well-being for all at all ages. Four, ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promote lifelong learning opportunities for all. Five, achieve gender equity and empower women and girls. Six, ensure the availability and sustainable management of water and sanitation for all. Seven, ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all. Eight, promote sustainable, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth, full and productive employment, and decent work for all. Nine, build resilient infrastructure, promote inclusive and sustainable industrialization, and foster innovation. Goal 10, this is the important human rights goal, reduce inequality within and among countries. 11, make cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. 12, ensure sustainable consumption and production patterns. 13, this is important, take urgent action to combat climate change and its impacts. And there's a footnote here that said, accordingly, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is the primary international intergovernmental forum for negotiating the global response to climate change. And that means the climate change conference in Paris. We need to get ready for that conference and make that conference a success. There are a few more, but my time is up, and I think I've given you a good flavor of what these goals are. You certainly can Google them and get more into them. Each one of these goals has targets and indicators. They get in quite a bit of detail, so there's a great deal of room for more study, and I know you're all you use, and you will Google, and you will study, because that's the kind of people that we are. So our next speaker is Reverend Peggy Clark, who is one of the organizers of the New York Climate March. She's very dedicated to this cause, and she's going to talk to us about how we can get ourselves organized and do something about this.
Can you introduce yourself, too, before you do the podcast?
Oh, yes, me. Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Bruce Knotts, and I'm the director of the Unitarian Universalist United Nations Office. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Reverend Peggy Clark, and one of my titles was prime organizer for the Unitarian Universalists during the People's Climate March. Was anyone in New York last September? Thank you. We had 1,500 Unitarian Universalists there. That's nearly 1% of our entire denomination showing up on the streets of New York for what was the largest climate march in history. Frankly, one of the largest marches in history. So Bruce has asked me today if I would talk about that march, talk about some organizing strategies, and maybe talk about what that means. We certainly need to be organizing for Washington, and we clearly need to be organizing for Paris. So what I learned and what happened there really helps to propel us forward. So let me tell you a little bit about that march and what I learned in terms of the organizing. That march happened out of nowhere, right? So the United Nations decided that this summit was starting in September, and people in New York said, well, we're right here. We should be doing something. There were five women. They had a conversation. They said, well, what if we just opened an invitation and see who shows up? Hundreds of people showed up because we're in New York, and that's what happens. And someone sent me an email while I was at GA last year, because a UU had shown up for that initial meeting. And she said, so I just went to this meeting, and there's going to be this march, and I thought maybe you could help and do something about it. And I was at a meeting at the time of the Environmental Justice Collaboratory. Do you know what that is? So last March, a group of people were brought together, 30 different people were brought together to talk about we were asked the question, given the task, how do you bring climate change, and really more specifically, how do you bring climate justice, how do you bring environmental justice into the UU agenda? So that's in March. That group is meeting again at GA. This email comes in, and I say, well, I guess I'm going to plan a march. Told all those folks there. Ministry for Earth was in the room. The UUA was in the room. The UUSC was in the room. And we said, well, let's see what happens next. And an organizing strategy started. And I will say that what happened is that we needed one point person, and then we needed a whole lot of ways to connect with a lot of other people to really grow energy. That march was designed geniusly so that at the very front were what we called frontline communities, the front of that march, who is most affected. Next we had what we called We Can Build the Future. They were families, it was labor, it was the elders. After that, we know who's responsible. We had this huge map, so everyone knew who's coming. And next group was we know who's responsible. All the social action people, the social justice people, people calling out policy. Next we had the debate is over, and this is interesting to me. In the debate is over section, we had the scientists and all of the faith groups together, marching together. We had more than 10,000 people of faith, more than 10,000 people of faith standing with the scientists saying the debate is over and marching together. Next we had to change everything, we need everyone. So then it started by neighborhoods, cities, states, nations, 400,000 people shut down New York City that day. And if you were there, I've lived there forever. There's really nothing like it. The city shut down. So part of what happened there is that the organizing, the connecting with all the interfaith groups, built a coalition that has continued to survive. So through this last year, we've continued to work together. There were a series of solidarity events. I think there were almost 200 solidarity events in New York that weekend. Those groups started additional coalitions so that all of those people continue to be in conversation with each other. So why does that matter? First of all, it kicks off a series of United Nations summits that will end in Paris in December. We need to be ready. We need to increase awareness about what's going on in Paris because it will affect the way that we live. It will affect the way that our children live. Whether or not this planet survives with humans on it, and it's going to survive, but it may not be with us, will depend on what happens there. So we have to be organizing. We have to be connected. 400,000 people got together, but that doesn't affect the billions of people on the planet, right? We have to keep making this happen. We have to call for policy that reduces carbon back under 350, and we have to demand that the countries, the nations that are most affected are at the table, that are part of the conversation. We have to say that the frontline communities, whether they are neighborhoods or nations, need to be in the conversation, that we have to be listening to the people who are affected. So when I think about what's next, I think that there are two things that we need. We need to change the way that we live, and we need to change the way that we think. The idea of changing the way that we live, it seems to me, is sort of heralded over and over. It's thrilling, frankly, to be having this conversation in Portland, to be in a platinum-certified LEED building. I have been in a few, but generally houses of worship. It's small. I have never seen a platinum-certified building this large before. It's astounding to me. I actually want to see if anyone let me into the back rooms there and see what's going on, or onto the roof. So I think we have some sense about what needs to change in terms of how we live. I don't know that we have a sense of what needs to change in terms of how we think. We need to dismantle the paradigm that allows us to throw some things away, that creates this dynamic that there's a dominant class and everyone and everything is in service to it, so that we no longer understand Earth as supply source and sewer, and that we no longer understand people as expendable or in service. So the Black Lives Matter movement is part of this justice movement. It's part of the climate change movement. We're part of the same dismantling. The immigration movement, to say that there are people without papers who are not expendable, that they are part of a full dynamic that we understand a single way, right? We have this paradigm that says some people are in and some people are out. Animals are out, people without papers are out, people of color are out, LGBTQ are out. If you're not physically able, you're out. Everyone is out, unless you are of service or of use to a dominant class, to a dominant paradigm. So if we want to be moving ahead, we need to get the policies created. We need the United Nations to step up and make that happen. We need to individually change the way that we live. And if we're really going to have sustainable change, we have to change the way that we think. And that is, I think, what that climate march was about. It was about saying everything has to change. Everything has to change. We are going to change everything. And for me, 400,000 people came out to say, let's do it. It was wildly exciting, and I think it was only how we start. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Reverend Kathleen McTeague. She heads up an exciting new organization, the UU College of Social Justice, which is a collaboration of UUSC and the UUA. It's just beginning, it's still kind of small, but I think it has a great future, and Kathleen's gonna tell us about their plans.
Thank you. It's not that small.
Okay.
And we're 3 years old, as some of you heard when I spoke to the general session. So I wanna tell you, I think I would like to begin with a few specifics of what the College of Social Justice has pulled together that is our offering, so to speak, in the realm of addressing climate change, but then talk in a somewhat more umbrella sense of what we're really trying to achieve with what we're offering. So our specific offering to the collaboration that is Commit to Respond, the College of Social Justice is one of the 9 organizations within the realm of Unitarian Universalism that are collaborating together on Commit to Respond. And what the College of Social Justice decided to do was to focus this year on three directions, really, for how we are using our justice training programs in the service of climate justice. One is bringing people to Hurricane Sandy recovery in Brooklyn, New York. Most of the people who have come with us to Brooklyn this year have been youth groups from congregations in the Northeast. A second has been our pilot program, which will certainly not be the last one, to the Lummi Nation in April. 14 people traveled with us there, many from the Pacific Northwest, but not all, because the Lummi Nation is one of the frontline nations that has organized with great effectiveness and power against the new rail lines that are bringing shale oil through their sacred lands and to a new port that the powers that be are hoping to build on their land. And the third is a climate justice training that we have organized for this August for young adults, specifically for young adults. We have 20 signed up, and we have decided to keep enrollment open through this coming Sunday in case there are a few who hear about it here at General Assembly. So if you know anybody from 18 to 34 who could benefit from this training, you can send them our way. It is really designed to help people who are already passionate about climate justice shift from being activists to being organizers. So one of the things we're trying to do is link them to communities of faith after this training, either the ones they're already linked to or to ones in their geographic area, so that they can bring some of the skills that they learn in the training directly to bear on a faith community. So those are three things that we have underway that are directly connected to climate justice. But what I want to do is sort of give you the umbrella framework that we're operating from. The first is that the College of Social Justice was created in order to offer programs that inspire and sustain faith-based justice work, locally, nationally, and globally. So the idea in our mandate is to create programs that get below just the book learning or the head learning that all of us can do. If you Google, for instance, the UN things that Bruce was listing, we do a huge amount of that. But what the college is trying to do is to give us tools or justice education programs that are not just head learning, that are heart learning, and in some cases body learning, because we are doing experiential programs. Experiential learning is the kind of learning that has the potential to literally change your life, because it presents you with this visceral awakening of a particular part of your reality that you had not yet encountered. If you're on a program that brings you face to face with the consequences of an injustice, it's extremely difficult to go back to business as usual. It really does ratchet you into a new place. It shifts things. We don't always know exactly how we've been changed or exactly how we want to shift the way we're doing justice work, but experiential learning is extremely powerful. So that's one part that is in all of College of Social Justice programs. The second thing is the justice framework that we bring into each of our programs. We want people to understand in a very holistic way the communities that we hope they will partner with. So to use an example, again, of the Hurricane Sandy program, it's really possible to go into a place like Brooklyn that has been impacted by a climate event and spend a week building a house and learn virtually nothing about the inequalities that created the vulnerabilities in that particular community, or the inequalities in the way that relief has come to those communities. The College of Social Justice wants people to understand institutional racism and the various ways in which communities historically have been marginalized by the structures of politics and economics that those of us who have not been marginalized can take for granted and not even see, frankly. They can be invisible to us. So the second sort of umbrella point that I'm trying to make is that with our programs, people are not just learning about the place that they go or the particular justice struggle there, but the broader context in which that justice struggle has become necessary. The third thing is the spiritual grounding. The College of Social Justice was founded to create programs that were grounded in our faith. When I was first invited to consider becoming the director of the College of Social Justice, when it was really pretty much an idea, it wasn't yet, you know, real on the ground, I asked the search committee what they meant by faith-based programs that they were envisioning. And the answer that I got was pretty heady. It was, well, we want the programs to teach something about the history of Unitarian Universalism when it comes to justice work, and to understand something about our theology and how it supports justice work. And my response was, well, I think that's fine, but what I would do, if you wanted me to be the director, would be to infuse the notion of contemplative practice as well into the programs that we offer. Because what we want is some possibility that the participants are changed by the experience, not just in their head learning, but in their hearts. So what we're looking for by bringing a deeper grounding, I think I would say, spiritual grounding to the programs, is the capacity to open ourselves to new, sorry, I'm going to step this way. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. We're looking for the capacity to be changed in ways that might surprise us. And I want to give you an example that doesn't directly have to do with climate change, but was quite riveting to me, and it crystallized some of what I think we're after. There is a movie that's fairly recent about immigration called Who is Dayani Cristal? And it traces the path of a man whose body was found in the desert without any identification on him. And an investigator decided to try to trace his trail that ended in his death in the Arizona desert. And the only evidence that he had to go on was a tattoo on the man's chest, which was Dayani Cristal. That was the name of the, that's how the name of the movie came about. In the course of this film, there is a moment in which a forensic scientist is interviewed. The job that this man holds is to receive human remains that are taken out of the Arizona desert and to try to hold on to some of those remains, to pass on the DNA evidence in the hope that at some point these bodies can be returned to the people who loved them when they were alive. So there's this incredibly powerful moment when this forensic scientist is looking straight into the camera and saying, you know, I just want to know the number. When we were pulling 100 bodies a year out of the desert, I thought surely that would be it. Then we hit 200. Now we're pulling 300 bodies out of our desert every year. And I just want someone in Washington to tell me what's the number at which point they will say, this shall not stand. And it just gave me goosebumps when I heard that man say that, because the depth of his moral outrage had drawn the line for him. I want us to know where the lines are, where our faith, our moral grounding, makes us stand up and say, this shall not stand. That is why we bring spiritual grounding into our programs. That is the goal. We want our people to face climate change through the lens of climate justice and to become as clear as possible about where it is we will say, this shall not stand. Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker is Dr. Jan Dash. When I took over as the director of the Unitarian Universalist UN office, we immediately got very much involved with human rights, LGBT rights, women's rights, indigenous people's rights. But as I was speaking in congregations around the country and around Canada as well, I stood at the back of the church and took people's congratulations, they said, what are you doing about climate change? And I realized that this was something that was really important to our movement and that we needed to get involved. And I really didn't feel that I personally had the expertise to do that. And so I was looking for somebody who had the scientific knowledge to be able to really take us to the next level on climate change issues. And I went to the Lincroft congregation in New Jersey, and I met Dr. Jan Dash, who volunteered to head up our climate task force. He now curates the climate change portal for the UUUNO and is an ever-growing network of climate action teams and climate networks that are working on climate change issues. He gave me a PowerPoint, which you've seen me struggling with throughout this session, And of course, just as he's getting ready to speak, my laptop has kind of gone belly up and we may not see the PowerPoint. But I give you Dr. Jan Dash, and we'll see how this works.
Well, I think that's a good lesson for all of you out there who think that geoengineering and technical solutions to climate change is going to work.
Not so much.
Okay, what I'd like to do is to speak about three things. The climate agreement, which we've already started to discuss. The final negotiations are going on now and will conclude in Paris in December. And the second is that there is a climate, as you probably know, there's a climate action for immediate witness at the GA here that's going to be voted on Saturday morning, and so I want to talk about that a little bit. And the third thing I want to discuss are the climate action teams that are starting now across the United States, facilitated by the UUUNO that Bruce mentioned. So Bruce mentioned the IPCC, that's the International Panel on Climate Change for the United Nations, that comes out with reports every 5 years. They're getting thicker and thicker and more serious. And the first slide that I was going to show you, but I can't, is a slide. Oh, wait a minute.
He's getting
there. Wait a minute, are we getting there? We can see half of one, so I'll just keep going because my time's going to run out. And so the first slide is going to show you scenarios that are projected by models by the year 2100, which is only 85 years from now, depending on what we do, everybody. And so the surface temperature is going up with some uncertainties, but there's no model that predicts that the temperature is going to go down. So what? Well, the so what is that the climate change impacts that are going to be produced constitute the greatest ethical and survival issue of our time. So all social justice issues that we care about are going to be impacted by climate change. If we don't solve the issue of climate change, there's going to be no solution for any social justice issue from immigration to human rights. So we're seeing bad impacts now. But the disasters that have always occurred are going to be made worse by climate change. And there's a whole litany of them, and I'm not going to go through all of them. I just want to mention a couple. The first that is probably a good one to use on your Republican uncle in the next Thanksgiving dinner are reports issued by the Defense Department, the Quadrennial Defense Reviews of 2010 and 2014, that talk about climate change as a national security threat. National security threat. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is that the sea level is rising. So I was at Copenhagen in 2009, and the oceanographer of the Navy, David Titley, was there, and he told me, and he talked about climate change, and afterwards I went up and I talked to him. He said that the Navy, U.S. Navy, runs scenarios for climate change rise in only 85 years of 1 to 2 meters. Okay, it doesn't mean that there will be 1 or 2 meters, but those are the scenarios, those are the risk scenarios that are being used. That's the first thing. Human rights, water shortages, crop failures, there's going to be food shortages, there's going to be water shortages, all kinds of really basic human needs. Bruce, it's okay. So one of the things that, I am a physicist actually, and I have been in finance risk management for a long time. One thing that I personally believe is that economic and financial systems that are naturally unstable could be destabilized by climate change. That will hit everybody. Okay, so those are the impacts, but we can act. We can mitigate climate change and global warming, and I believe that the framework, the proper framework in which to pose action on climate change is climate change risk management. Climate change risk management. Now, one of the things that I used to do is I was a choral conductor for an opera company. And so I'm going to put on my costume here. This is my Paris hat. And now you guys are all the climate chorus. So what we're going to do is say climate risk management. Ready? Say it. Climate risk management. That's very good. You're a very good chorus. Okay, now you've said it, and that is the framework that we should be using to talk about climate change. It is the framework. Whoa.
Start over.
Okay, so I can move over here.
I wouldn't no advice.
Well, so he can see what's up there.
Oh, yeah.
Can you? Oh, now you're asking, can I? Oh.
Can you scroll down?
I don't. I'm not.
All right. Well, that's.
I'm not there yet.
All right. Well, that's the graph. Okay, let's keep going. So, there action is needed from all levels, from local to global, and there's no silver bullet. There's no silver bullet. So instead of thinking of 100% solution to climate change, think of 25% solutions. That's the way we'll actually solve it. There are plenty of positive opportunities going forward. The whole fossil fuel industry, several trillion dollars, is going to have to transition to renewable energies. That's going to be positive opportunities, which means that rather than thinking of cost of climate change mitigation, we can actually think of positive opportunities of climate change mitigation. Okay, so what I want to talk about is the International Climate Agreement in Paris, and I want to talk about a few of the issues. Why is it so hard to get a climate agreement? Well, one of the reasons is that there's a carbon budget, so we can't burn all the carbon that's in the ground because that will lead to unacceptable climate impacts. So about roughly half the carbon that is recoverable now has to stay in the ground. So that's the first problem. So why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem because, for example, on an ethical basis, developing countries want to develop. They want to develop their economies. The cheapest and easiest way to do it is with fossil fuels. So there's a natural conflict. There's a natural conflict also from cumulative emissions that are up in the atmosphere, most of which have been produced by the United States, the European Union, other developed countries. But developing countries are starting to contribute more and more, and they cannot actually burn the fossil fuel that they would like to burn to develop their economies without unacceptable consequences to the planet, to humanity, even if we cut our emissions to zero. So that's another problem. Legal status, an agreement versus a treaty, what is the enforcement mechanism? Who pays for technological assistance, support for adaptation, and reparations, and how much and how will that work? So those are basically the issues. Okay, so turn a page. So what is the status? The status basically is that there's not enough climate risk management action with international action consistent with increasing climate impacts. And UU should and can show leadership to help. So this brings me to the climate agreement AIW, which is an action of immediate witness. So everybody, please tell your delegates that there is this action of immediate witness. Please tell your delegates to show up tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock and vote. So I'll just read a piece of that. How much time do I have? Okay, so I'm not gonna read the action of immediate witness, but I will just read one sentence from it from Peter Morales and Bill Shultz. The crisis of climate change is the gravest threat facing our world today. So that's, oh, okay. Can you go to the next slide then, please? Next slide. Okay, so this is the climate agreement action of immediate witness, and this is what it says. So you can actually see it, but it will be presented to you tomorrow morning, and it's Act for a Livable Climate. Vote yes on it. Okay, next slide. So please tell your delegates to show up 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Go to the UU MFE booth 306. Okay, that's the end of the climate AIW. Next slide, please. So the next is to talk about the climate action teams that Bruce mentioned and also that Peggy mentioned. So UUs are very good at passing resolutions, not so good at organizing. Right, so we need to get better organized, everybody. And one of the ways that we think is a very good idea is climate action teams. So the goal is to have a climate action team in every congregation in the United States and also in Canada. That's the ultimate goal. Why? The goal is then to have somebody or some group of people in every congregation that can do whatever they want for climate change action. And we have a pamphlet here, which is going to be at the UUUNO booth 516 in the exhibit hall, just behind the jewelry, okay, where you can sign up your team, even one person who's interested in climate change at your organization, sign up as a climate action team. We have 23 now. Let's try to get 50 by tomorrow, everybody. So everybody, there's lots of people in the room here. Go to the UUUNO booth and sign up to be a climate action team. Why would we want to do that? Well, first of all, we're networking everybody together so one climate action team can know what another one is doing, which is very valuable. And also, when something like this AIW or divestment or commit to respond actions come up, we're already organized, and so the communication is facilitated. So the next slide. So this is the UU10 portal. You can also go to the UU10 portal. The URL is there. Go to the front page and just scroll down and click on forming a climate action team. Okay, next slide. Okay, so climate is a big problem, and we can solve it. We can solve it, everybody. We can solve it with present technology, although future technology will be a big help. The vulnerable are going to be the most severely impacted. That's what we have been speaking about here up at the table. But make no mistake about it, climate change will hit our descendants very hard, everybody in this room. There will be no place to hide under business as usual. So support the climate AIW at GA, form a climate action team. We have to be optimistic. There's really no alternative. And you can help. Last slide. Thank you very much. And thanks to Bruce for getting this to work.
Pardon?
Thanks to you for getting this to work.
I think this is that's your grandson. Anyway. Just one last couple of words. One is that our programs at the UUNO, we're now an office of the UUA, and we're very much part of the Commit to Respond. So everything that we're doing is all weaved into the UUA, UUSC, UU College of Social Justice, all the work that we're doing together to Commit to Respond on climate change. And there are many things that we can do locally, in our homes, in our congregations, but there also needs to be a global dimension, and that's what we've tried to lift up here, is that unless we get global agreements, and there's a chance of doing that in Paris in December, unless we get really serious about that, we're in serious trouble. And so we need to put pressure on our legislators. This has been a great liberal progressive week. Let's go for one more. We've got same-sex marriage, and we've got Obamacare. Now let's get... Yes, so we can let's go for some meaningful leadership at the Paris meeting. So we are ready for questions, and we do have a mic here. And please state your name and where you're from.
Is this working? Yeah.
Yes.
My name is George Tenef. I'm from Vista, California. It's not really a question. You had all these UN goals that you stated, but they're ultimately self-defeating. Let me give you an example. In South Africa...
Speak right into the mic.
Okay.
Yeah. You can take it out if you want.
Okay. In South Africa, some of those goals were worked towards access to modern health services, food security, and clean water. And the response of the native population was to start doubling every 15 years. So none of those goals are really achievable unless we first empower women in the third world and give them access to birth control.
Good.
David Overton from First Unitarian Church of Dallas. We have a climate action team there. I really wanted to ask maybe for Jan, with respect to Paris, we'd really love to know what we can do.
Use the mic.
Into the mic, okay? Yeah. With respect to Paris, what we can do, and for example, should we be writing to our Secretary of State or to our UN ambassador? What are some, some concrete things that we can do?
Okay, so thank you for that. Just to give an idea of what's going on now, the negotiating text for the Paris Agreement has been posted. Now known, and it's being cut down because it's way too long. The legal negotiations are going on now. However, there's always last-minute stuff that goes on. If you followed any of these climate negotiations, you know that the negotiators negotiate for 6 days, and then they stay up all night, and there's last-minute stuff that happens. So anything's possible. So anything that the Unitarian Universalists can do organizing themselves to provide a uniform voice to try to influence the climate negotiations through direct contact with the climate negotiators. That would mean Todd Stern, the State Department, and your representatives and senators. It all counts. There's also part of the AIWs to endorse a group of UUs to go to Paris itself to try to influence things on the ground. Now, this is something that involves 197 countries. We can't fool ourselves that we can have a big influence, but we can have some influence and we can try.
One thing I'd like to say in that regard is if you poll Americans or actually people across the world, do you think climate change is important? The vast majority of people say that it is. If you ask them what is the most important or the most top three things that you care about, often climate change doesn't make that list. And the politicians look at that and then they say, well, I can just kind of ignore climate change and work on jobs or work on something else. So we've got to constantly talk to our political leaders, our members of Congress, senators, and the administration to let them know that, yes, we do care about a lot of other things, but climate change is damn important to us. Sorry for the profanity there, but it's important.
Hear, hear. Is this okay like this?
Yeah. Go a little closer to it.
Okay. All of us who care about climate need to be sure our members of Congress know that we care. And I was just in Washington, D.C., with the Citizens Climate Lobby, which is a non-partisan group, and Politico put out this one-page ad with the Pope. We have a moral obligation to act on climate change, the Pope and evangelicals. So what about, is this a crazy idea? What if we did something similar, that Unitarian Universalists care about climate change, and we want action in the UN climate talks? So that just came up with that suggestion. I also wanted to ask Peggy, who is such a wonderful march organizer, the Moral March on Climate, that's going to be in Washington, D.C. on September 20th. And the purpose of that is to push the climate, a fair and just climate agreement. And the Pope is going to be visiting a few days after that in both D.C. and in New York. So will we be having a UU contingent?
We will. Is anyone in here one of the prime organizers? There you go. So I've been, you wanted to raise your hand again? Okay, it went down, so maybe that was a mistake. So yes, there is a group. They are doing the organizing. They have asked me to create, to help them to kind of figure out what the first and last steps are to make that happen. I like the idea of the ad, but actually I think a more powerful thing for us to do would be to enter or to continue the partnership we have with Catholics and evangelicals around climate change. We are already in relationship there and could talk with them about an interfaith statement and include in that the our UCC partners, our Methodist partners, our Jewish partners. There's really a strong coalition, and ours is amplified when we join with other voices.
Also, just to let you know that the UUNO does plan to have a presence in Paris. I think Jan Dash is going to be there, and Peggy, and others. I think the UUNO does have a status with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which means we can accredit delegates, observer delegates to that conference, and we're doing that. We don't know what our quota is yet, but eventually we'll have a quota. Yes.
This is a question about Bob Goggin.
And name and congregation, please.
Bob Goggin from First Parish in Waltham, Massachusetts. This is a question about resources within our congregations, and that is that the sources and resources have become so heavily politicized. I think it would be very helpful to have something with sort of recognizable scientific credentials. And I'm wondering, a quick example would be the first time I ever heard Rush Limbaugh about 10 years ago, he was talking about climate change. I thought it was a parody. I couldn't imagine that anyone of any sense would believe what he was saying. So if we're looking for something that would have the scientific credentials, is there something in particular that you could recommend that is relatively current that would, short of 300 pages, be a good resource for congregations to have?
Yes, skepticalscience.com. 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 So what that is a compendium of fallacies, contrarian deniers, whatever you want to call them, and with one sentence responses, and in more detail if you want more. So anything that Rush Limbaugh says is going to be one of the fallacies.
Let me.
I would like to suggest something too.
Skeptical. Skepticalscience.com. That's the best. That's the best go-to resource.
I've got two other suggestions for you, though.
Let me ask the question another way, though. Instead of starting with the error and working
right.
through to a an explanation, is there something that you would recommend as a primer?
Can I make two suggestions? Sure. You may have others too. There are two that I think are extremely accessible and very worth reading. One, believe it or not, is The Papal Encyclical that just came out last week. It's very science-based, even though it is also very grounded morally and religiously. The other is Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything.
Yeah.
It's an excellent resource, and on the College of Social Justice website, there is a discussion guide for it. So if you wanted not only to read it, but to bring it to a circle within your congregation, that might be a useful way to unpack some of the science.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
A third source is the UUUNO Climate Portal. It's a soup to nuts climate website. It has what you need.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marty McKenzie, Towson, UUC, Greater Baltimore Cluster, and also UU for SJ in the Greater Capital Region. And I have good news. Just before I came up, we have verified we had more than 150 signatures, so the Act for a Livable Climate will be voted on tomorrow. And not only do we need to vote tomorrow, hopefully we're in the three, and hopefully we'll be the top three on Sunday. So if there are any delegates here who do not have a copy of it, I have extra. And a final comment. September 20th is my birthday, and I want you to all join the big party in D.C., and I look forward to seeing you.
I'm David Tucker. I am a member of Eno River Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Durham, North Carolina, where Bruce came to speak before. Thank you again for doing that. And I am an environmental professional. In my professional life, I work for the Environmental Finance Center at UNC Chapel Hill. And so I'm very interested in the work of the UN and the UUUNO in general, but especially in this area, which I think is so critical. My question is, in what ways, along the climate change angle, are you collaborating with the UU MFE in their environmental work? Related question, how are the climate action teams, you know, similar to or different from some of their initiatives like the Green Sanctuary Program, and is there any effort to, you know, have some kind of coordination or collaboration there, because I think that's the way forward on a lot of things. Like we saw this morning, the presentation about the coordinated campaign for all the different UU groups, I think that's a brilliant idea. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. And climate finance actually is a big issue. It comes up at the UN all the time. I know Tim Brennan from the UUA comes to a lot, there he is in the back. He goes to a lot of these meetings at the UN on finance and ethical financing with regards to climate and a lot of other issues. As far as the climate action teams, this is not per se a UUUNO program. It is something that everybody has access to. And we are very closely collaborating with the UU Ministry for Earth, with the Green Sanctuary Program, and with all of the UU organizations and even non-UU organizations that are working on climate justice and climate issues. What we're trying to do, and we're using our good offices to try to get congregations to get some people together to work on climate issues. And then we have congregational polity. That's the kind of people we are. So it's up to you guys to decide those issues that you care about the most. Is it the Keystone Pipeline? Then UUMFE, probably that's the right people to talk to. Is it the climate summit in Paris? Then you probably want to talk to us, because we probably have some good information on that. Do you want to do something with your sanctuary and make it environmentally, you know, right? Then you talk to the Green Sanctuary. I want to say one other thing, and this has been my own learning on climate issues, is that what we eat has a huge impact on the climate. And where we source our food from has a huge impact on the climate. A kiwi that came from New Zealand probably has a huge carbon footprint. And if we buy something that's grown locally, it has a much lower carbon footprint. So ethical eating is a huge issue.
And as a big eater myself, I sometimes have problems, but I think the more and more we get in touch with what we eat and how we eat and talking to the ethical eating folks really, I think, is a good thing for all of us. And then, yeah.
So, well, thank you for that. I chair the Food Justice Ministry, so that was pretty awesome. Not what I was going to say, but that was really cool. So I just wanted to respond in that this last year has seen what I would call an unprecedented moment in Unitarian Universalist history around collaboration. With Commit to Respond in particular, but even before that, the Environmental Justice Collaboratory brought together 40 different UU groups into one room to say, let's create one agenda. And from that, wrote this open letter and moved one step further and created Commit to Respond. And while Commit to Respond now has 9 sponsoring organizations, it has dozens of UU endorsing organizations and interfaith organizations, not just UU, so that it has created a collaboration I don't think we've ever seen before. And I think that climate change, because of its multidimensional nature, has granted us an opportunity to be in conversation with each other in a way we hadn't even considered really before.
Yeah, just to say something about climate action team, this is a program that we've been trying to facilitate now for several years before Commit to Respond started. It actually is something that is kind of independent in a way, but connected in a way with all the other things. And what it really means is if we had somebody or some small group in every congregation, then, as Bruce said, whatever comes up, if they're interested in it, they can act on it, and we can all act together. So it's something that is generic. It's at a 50,000-foot level. What we need to do is to have a presence in every congregation of somebody that's interested in climate change that knows what is, that is connected with all the other groups.
So, hi, I'm Connie from Fresno, California, and our congregation recently voted on a resolution on climate change, which is patterned after the UUA resolution of several years ago.
Can you get a little closer to your mic so people in the back will hear you?
Okay, sure. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Also, our Green Sanctuary Committee basically has decided that we're going to align ourselves pretty closely with Citizens Climate Lobby. They have a solution, and research has found that people are most likely to take action when they really think there is a solution. And often when you talk to people, they don't. But Citizens Climate Lobby does feel that it has a solution, which is basically putting a price on carbon. And so my question is, what is the likelihood, what's the possibility of UUA actually aligning itself with a single organization, as in Citizens Climate Lobby, so that we're all headed in the same direction and we can leverage our power and build upon what CCL is already doing? They have so many resources. They have a group called Pathway to Paris that's already working on preparing for Paris. So what's the possibility of actually UUA and all these other UU organizations working together on that?
So I just got back from Washington, D.C. with the Citizens Climate Lobby on the Hill, and you did too. And so did probably a number of other people in the room. So there are many, many ways that we can act on climate. Citizens Climate Lobby is definitely one of them, but it's not the only one. Unitarians are kind of hard to organize. It's a little bit like herding cats. So I don't see that that's going to happen, but it is really encouraging that at last the UUA and UUSC and other Unitarian organizations are all standing up now and saying, look, climate change really is important. It's a priority, and we have to do something. We have to act. When something specific comes along, for example, the divestment campaign or something like that, then we can act. If it's fee and dividend, if people want to get behind that, that's fine, too. I don't see that the UUA is going to endorse one specific thing, however.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Christine Carmona. I'm from the UU Church of West Valley in Glendale, Arizona. And I've been studying this climate change for a while now, and I believe that what's causing it isn't just us human beings. I believe what's mainly causing it is that those people that are putting those chemtrails up in the sky, those white stripes that don't go away, unlike contrails that instead, they widen out and they cover the whole sky. And what they have in them is aluminum, strontium, and beryllium, barium. and other toxic chemicals, and they cause respiratory systems. They cause problems with the respiratory systems. And the government's telling us that they're putting those stripes in the sky in order to lower the to combat climate change. But what they're really doing is controlling the weather. They actually have a document on the internet put out by the military to be able to control the weather by 2025. And it's for war things, so that they can win battles against other countries, and also so that for people that are making bets on what the weather's going to be, so that they can win. And it's really damaging to us. So what I'm asking you is, what can we do to stop this this toxic chemical spraying that they keep doing all
Thank
over
you.
The world?
Thank you. Any comments? Next question, please.
Yes. My name is Dan Rigney. I'm from Emerson UU in Houston. I'm on a CAT team there. And our project is to get every single congregation in the greater Houston area.
Mike.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Now we can.
Okay. From Emerson in Houston, and our project is to get every congregation in the Houston area to switch to 100% renewable energy, whether through solar or through the grid, or however. If you would be interested in joining us in this effort and taking it beyond Houston, we have a hashtag up on Twitter. It's hashtag renewable congregations. That's it. No spaces. If you're interested in getting your congregation 100% renewable, just go to Twitter, hashtag renewable congregations. Thank you.
I think that's amazing, and that's what we are trying to do. That's the whole purpose of the climate action teams, because a lot of congregations are doing some really great work, and nobody knows what everybody else is doing. And so we're trying to establish some kind of network where congregations can talk to each other and everybody can kind of share information, and so everybody knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I would also suggest, again, UUs have a bad habit sometimes of reinventing the wheel, and to pay attention to Interfaith Power and Light, which has been around for a long time and is linking congregations way beyond our little denomination. So they're easily found on the internet. They've got lots of resources available.
Yes, sir.
Donald Gerson, Paint Branch, UU Church, Adelphi, Maryland. What I have not been hearing mentioned are the ramifications of climate change, the result of rising sea level in terms of refugees. For example, I've heard some astounding numbers of the number of in Bangladesh with the rising sea level of a couple of meters. That can really, these are startling numbers, and we haven't been talking about it. We've been talking about climate change itself.
Thank you very much for that question. Let me, I'll tell you a story. So we were going to have a seminar on LGBT rights, and we were talking to the Israeli mission to the UN. We were talking about, and they were going to help us set up a meeting at the UN on LGBT rights. And just in passing, we mentioned that we also work on climate change. And so the Israeli diplomat said, oh, the small island states are feeling ignored. Nobody's listening to them, and sea levels are rising, and their populations are being inundated. So we took it upon ourselves to hold some sessions at the UN, also at NYU, New York University, to give the ambassadors from the small island states an opportunity to talk about what's going on with them. And what they said was that, yes, they're losing their land. And they are not really interested in immigrating to Australia or to America or to any place else, because they have their own distinctive language, culture, customs that they've had for centuries. They're not interested in becoming something else. They're quite happy with what they're doing. And some of these small island states are using solar power. They're doing everything right as an example to the rest of us that we're not paying attention to. And if we were doing what they're doing to have sustainable energy, their islands wouldn't be disappearing under the water. I used to be a refugee officer for the U.S. government, and I know refugee law, both international and domestic law.
There's no law, either domestic or international, that gives you the right to be a refugee because your country has disappeared because of climate change. So there's no legal way for these people even to be asylum seekers or refugees. So there needs to be some attention to change the law, even to give people not an opportunity to go to another country. Some of the South Pacific Islanders are already moving to Australia, and Australia seems to be willing to take a certain number. But it's going to be a catastrophic thing going forward. The more we can do to limit the effects of climate change and save some of these islands, the better. But we also need to prepare for massive amounts of people that are going to be leaving their countries.
Excuse me, but it's not just island nations.
I know. It's Bangladesh, and it's Norfolk, Virginia.
Yeah.
It's Norfolk, Virginia. It's Manhattan, where I live. It's Boston. It's all over. Yes, I get it.
We need to scare people a little bit. I mean, this is huge.
I think people are quite scared. I'm scared. We also need to have hope.
I don't want to bend down. My back won't like that. I'm Carolyn Woodbury. I'm from San Diego First Church. And I apologize before I even say another word to anyone who was here yesterday when I made a plug for Interfaith Power and Light, and also for if you have not yet put solar panels on your house of worship because you don't think you can afford it, please come and talk to me.
Very good. Oh, we got a hot one here. This is a good question. I can just tell.
I'm Julie Steinbeck from Monte Vista Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Montclair, California. And I have one comment and one question. My comment about the CCL question is that my congregation, as well as Neighborhood Church in Pasadena, are both the locations where the CCL groups meet. And we started doing that a year or so ago, and it's a great way for us to not only stand up for what we believe in, but also for other people to be attracted to us, learn about who we are, and are coming and joining our congregation. So that is already happening. My question is that the Parliament of World Religions, as you know, will be happening in Salt Lake and in October, and it's the first, a lot of us on the western part of the country are planning on going, and I'm wondering what kind of climate change activism or consciousness connecting, global connecting there will be there that you're aware of.
I was actually invited to that conference. I don't have the budget to go, so I'm not going. I'm sure people from the UUA are going. I'm thinking probably Eric Cherry is going, who's the head of the international office. I hope there's some networking. I can only speak about the United Nations. First of all, climate change is Ban Ki-moon's Secretary General's top priority. It's the issue he cares about the most. And you know, I work at the church center at the UN, and we have all the religious organizations around us, and there's a lot of issues like LGBT rights where they don't agree with us, and we're not in full agreement. The one issue that really brings people of faith together is climate change. It doesn't matter whether they're Catholic or they're evangelical or Jewish or Hindu or whatever they are. I think people of faith are really getting around the climate change issue, and I think building coalitions and building networks of people of faith is a really smart thing to do. And I think the more we do it, the better we'll get at it, and the better we get at it, the more effective we'll all be.
I think the papal encyclical was very significant, and we should note that the response to the papal encyclical by Peter Morales and Bill Schultz came out in direct. And so I think that that is going to be something that is very noteworthy in not only in terms of the Catholic response, but of other faith organizations that heretofore haven't really been too vocal.
Lynn Dash, Lynn Croft, New Jersey, and we are members of the Monmouth Center, that's our county, for World Religions and Ethical Thought, and I have brought up the issue of climate change with them. There is a book that, in fact, Citizens Climate Lobby put out about faith statements from all different faiths about climate, and what we're talking about doing in conjunction with the People's Climate March. We're in New Jersey. They say everybody can't make it to D.C., but let's have a vigil, interfaith vigil for a good good, just climate agreement. So we're going to be doing that on an interfaith way also.
Great. And last one, I guess.
Hi, I'm Elaine Denafe from Vista, California. And I appreciate what you're saying about different faiths coming together and sort of fighting together for this this item. But I've noticed that most of the people that I encounter who are global change deniers tend to be very conservative Christian people. Do you have any suggestions of how to face that or combat that when you come across deniers?
We talk about this a lot and in a lot of different contexts, and maybe our other speakers have some viewpoints on this. I think you have to gauge who you're talking to. And if they're dyed-in-the-wool conservative and they just stuck where they are, it probably is not worth your breath talking to them because you're probably not going to get through. There is sort of that middle group. I've seen a lot of research, and I've actually had a lot of training in this. Here in the United States, 90% of the people vote either Republican or Democrat, always. They vote always Republican or always Democrat. And there's 10% called the movable middle that vacillate back and forth. Most of our presidential elections are decided by Ohio and Florida. And the rest of us could, But so it's that group in the middle that are maybe a little doubtful, maybe, not unsure about climate change, and they want more information. Those are the people with whom I think it's really valuable to have conversations. But if they're really stuck, I would think, but maybe you have a different point.
I think that that's correct, that you don't want to waste energy if you're not going to change somebody's mind. But I also think it's really important to notice the conservative, theologically conservative congregations, particularly in the African American community, who have elevated climate justice and climate change in a way that our congregations haven't yet. I mean, they're way ahead of us in some ways. So it's important to notice that and not sort of lump everybody together. And the other thing I would say is, to some degree, we have to know where our own power is. And I think that where we can best exert power is moving those who already are absolutely convinced of climate change into action, rather than just trying to change people's minds. Because there are an awful lot of people who believe it's real who are really stuck in inaction.
Just one other thing, and we haven't said enough, I think, about climate justice, because that's a real important dimension here. And so what is Bruce? What does Bruce really care about? If you heard Marlon Lavenhar's thing, I'm going to disclose my secrets here. I care about gay rights. I care about LGBT rights. I'm absolutely ecstatic about the decision today. And I've had climate people tell me, you should give up on LGBT rights and just work on climate change for the next 10 years. I'm 65 years old. I'm not waiting to 75 years old to start working on LGBT rights. And it was reading Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, that really got me very passionate about climate change, because it will change everything. We need, and I've heard African Americans say, this isn't my issue, but it is their issue. It's all our issues, because what Peggy was saying at the very beginning, there's this concept of disposable people. People of color are disposable. LGBT people are disposable. This paper is disposable. You just throw away people, throw away garbage, and we don't care about it. We've got to change that mindset where no person is disposable, no resource is disposable. We need to care for the planet, for our resources, and for our people. And on that basis, everybody gets involved, and everybody's agenda is included.
Amen.
Okay.
We need to end.
All right. I think we're done. Thank you. I think we're done. Yeah.
I gotta go to another one. Nice to see you again.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Sorry about being the man behind the screen.
That's all right.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to meet you. I'm sorry about your PowerPoint.
Oh, that's so. We got half of it. That was very good.
Hey, Larry.
And the
Hi. I'm Dan Rigdon from Houston.
That's really good to hear.
Trying to get renewable congregation.
Fabulous.
As a movement.
I love it.
And we're starting in Houston. We've almost got Houston in the bag.
Love it.
But I wanted to tell you, I'm with Hope Set Up the campaign at both First UU Houston and Emerson Houston. So two of your.
Where do you think the preference points are?
I just wanted to know whether you knew of anybody else who's trying to get their own congregations or other congregations to switch to 100% renewable, because that's a really obvious thing, especially now that renewable energy is price competitive.
Yeah, so our function with climate action teams is not to tell them what to do. So. In other words, on these calls, you know, bring it up.
Okay, yeah. And I'm sorry I missed the last call by a few minutes.
That's okay.
I was on the first call, not good. The second. I'll try to be on the third.
Good, anyway. Excellent.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. Oh, hi. 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 Hi.
And I'm at Colorado State University.
Oh, good.
And so is my husband. He's at
Oh, what's his name?
Bill Parton.
Oh, good.
He does a lot with swords and swords. So
oh, great.
I'm an anthropologist, so I do human dimensions of climate change.
Cool.
And I'm going to a conference in Slavonia in November.
Oh, wow.
In November. Oh, yeah. To work on a project, an international project of anthropologists and climate change.
Cool.
I just want to get more connected on what's going on, and then maybe the dates in Paris, because if I'll be in Europe.
Well, Paris is the first week. So Paris is the first 2 weeks in December. Yeah, you can. Yeah, and the first week is generally talks and side events.
This is the UN. A good friend of mine, anthropologist, also works for the UN, and I know she'll be there.
Yeah. And then the second week is when all of the negotiators show up.
I'm frustrated with the technology.
Your interest is the first week, right? Because you can't actually get into the negotiations.
Yes,
what do you want from the booth?
Okay.
Well, we got the reception coming up. And so that's kind of our next thing. We're kind of about to get ready for that.
Well, it's not that we want anything, but if one of the things that you could do is
anything you need,
climate action.
Go and take it. What do you need? Do a handout?
So I just learned about that. I will try that.
Yeah. You need a what? Oh.
All we need is one person.
Well, you should definitely check it out.
Okay.
That's it. So just go sign up. And, you know, from then on, it's we don't have anything. Unitarians are not organized.
I'm learning that.
So we need to get better organized. And, so the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of grumbling about the sustainable development goals in here today.
From then on, about the Paris conference? I mean,
the UN, everything that it does is only as good as we make it. You know, it's the member states that, you know, either make this all succeed. You know, all the UN can do is convene. It convenes people and tries to bring people together and encourage them to act globally, act together on issues that are important. And then the rest is up to us. And so if things are failing, it's up to us. It's not the UN's fault, really.
Right here,
I don't think there's any problem with the Security Council. Syria is a problem with the Security Council. Ukraine is a problem with the Security Council. But I don't think there's any problem with the Security Council. And then the Unitarians are just not organized at all.
So then you're just there.
Well, that's okay. But I want, if I
would love to talk to you more about this. I know that you're a wealth of knowledge.
Well,
you know,
it's not considered a security issue, even though it is a security issue.
Well, that's, I wouldn't mind if I could find out how to get connected. I guess that's what I'm saying. Have a good connection.
Do you have a card?
I didn't bring a card tonight. I never thought twice
that's
about
the game
my academic background.
Thanks. I really love your comments. Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, Bruce, we finally did it, right?
Thank you.
No, it was good, right?
It didn't cross my mind to bring that.
It's true.
And then I had the academic cards.
No, that's right.
Because I didn't think I was doing anything.
Hey, Jan, I just wanted to say hi. I've got to run to my next workshop, but I'd love to talk to you at some point.
Tell me when. Anytime is fine, Tim.
Yeah, let me just give you a card, and then we'll figure it out.
All right. I have a card, too. I'm trying to find it, however.
But
I'll give you a call.
Bruce keeps telling me I've got to meet you, and so I'm glad to meet you briefly.
Yeah,
and
let's do it.
Are you around?
I'll be around the rest. Tomorrow I'll be here.
Okay, well, I'll try and find you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be at the AIW, so if you come to that. All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you find it?
No. Hey, Larry, how you doing?
I was working on the just turned my
good.
Excellent. This,
oh, your house. Oh, hey, good to meet you. Yes,
I just want to say.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Larry. Thanks for coming. Very good, very good. Okay, good. Very good.
Probably introduce myself to
Bruce. So why don't you introduce yourself to Bruce, because he's actually the one you want to talk to.
As far as the organization.
Yeah. He's the one.
If you find one, hand it to me, but if you don't.
Yeah,
you're in New Jersey, huh?
Yeah.
Are you with the university there? Are you working with?
No, I work in the city. So.
In the city?
Yeah, I do risk management. I work for Bloomberg.
Oh, okay.
So that's what I do.
Okay.
I do risk management.
Yeah, my husband does climate modeling, and he does work all around the world. Like, he works in Australia. We just got back from a month in Australia, and he's been doing this for years. So.
I love this guy.
And he'll be with me, and that's why I figured if I can, find some way to connect.
Very good. Here, hang on.
Yeah, and I didn't bring a single card with me. It never crossed my mind. I didn't know you've got another potential.
Can I borrow your pencil for a pencil?
Sure.
Good. Okay. And your name was?
Lenora Boren.
Lenora, okay, I can see it. Boren. Okay.
And I'm at Colorado State.
Colorado State. Good.
I put my name in there.
Good.
Well, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Okay, very good.
Jan, I'm David Tucker.
Hey, David.
It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, David.
So you're a physicist.
I am.
Environmentalist,
yes.
Par excellence.
Well, I don't know par excellence, but I am. Yeah, I've worked for a long time with climate change, and it sounds like you have some experience, too.
Well, I do. I'm a career changer, so about, let's see, what is this, 7 years ago, went to grad school at Duke University to the Nicholas School of the Environment,
sure.
Master's of
Environmental Management.
Our former dean, Bill Chimedes.
Yeah, Bill Chimedes.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. So I actually offline.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually do risk management at Bloomberg, but I know Eric Ross now. I know all those people.
Yeah. How about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm not supposed to say anything, but I will. But don't tell anybody.
I will keep whatever you're about to say to myself.
Okay. So they're about to launch a big. You know what they call it, publicity about the Keeling curve. And so what they want to do is to run a real-time
Keeling curve,
carbon dioxide measurements from Mauna Loa. Keeling started it. And so what they need is is real-time numbers, mm-hmm. but the numbers that come in are actually monthly numbers. They're actually weekly, but they're average for monthly purposes of the year.
They need richer data.
So I have a trick that I use, which I got from geophysics, actually, that I use for forecasting purposes. And so I'm able to forecast the Keeling curve, and then we could, we back tested it. We could show that it's actually quite accurate. So they're going to use those numbers for So anyway, one of the things that we did was we wrote a paper and we sent it to Gavin Schmidt, who actually liked it. And mm-hmm. we also sent it to Bill Comedes, but he didn't respond. So
right.
he must be incredibly busy or something.
Well, now that he has stepped down as our dean, I'm a little confused about what he's up to. I know he's going to continue to be a member of the faculty at the Nicholas School. But if I know Chimedes, he's probably up to, like, all kinds of other things as we speak. I'm just not really sure what they are. And we got a wonderful new dean. He had been the dean of a very similar program at the University of Colorado Boulder. In fact, he had set up that program in part copying the Nicholas School. And he's more or less on leave right now because his wife is very, very sick. And so I think there are others who are kind of stepping up to kind of fill in for not having a fully active dean in the Nicholas School at the moment. I'm down the road at the other Blue School now, working at the Environmental Finance Center, UNC Chapel Hill, but I get over to the Duke of
Environmental Finance, so that fascinates me, actually.
Well, me too. And I think we've just scratched the surface of a much broader area because, we're a fairly small center, so there's some things we are doing and there's some things we're not doing, but...
You're involved with green bonds or any of that stuff?
Somewhat. We work a lot in water and wastewater. We work a fair amount in energy. And for me, I started off all on clean energy at the Nicholas School. Then they put me to work quite a bit on water at the EFC where I'm now. And so I'm seeing more and more of the intersection between the two, which is very interesting. And we work in some other areas too, stormwater and solid waste and green infrastructure.
Okay.
So, stuff about green bonds has crossed our radar a little bit. Like, who is he? The District of Columbia? They passed the first century-long green bonds?
Yep, that's well known. There's another one that's supposed to be coming out in Manila, I think. And I think it's connected with the harbor or something. I'm not really sure.
The harbor for, Chesapeake Bay or something?
No, Manila, the Philippines.
Oh, in the Philippines. Jan, do you have a card on you?
I have tons of cards and they all disappear. Oh, you know where? I bet they are. I bet they're in here. Here they are.
I just used up my current supply, but I think I have more back in my room somewhere. Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Trying to make this connection.
Yes. So So I think climate finance is actually the critical issue right now.
If you can't figure out how to pay for it, it's probably not going to happen in so many cases.
There you go. Also, climate economics. I've started to get into some of the climate economic models because mm-hmm. that's, for climate denial, that's one of the two trees they hide behind. Besides the hiatus.
It's one of the things that I miss working on these days because I studied econ a lot in school and I was a TA for an econ class at Duke. And, obviously, finance overlap, but our center kind of tries to stay mostly just to things that are currently priced in the market, and therefore you can go out and get a loan for it and finance it and what have you. I miss that because, especially in this area, in climate change, you have to be looking at stuff that is not currently priced. You just have to. You're looking at, a price on carbon or a cap and trade or a tax or, rebates or something like that. So
one of the things that I've been trying to wrap my arms around is certainly